My name is Burns Brady, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Burns.
Hi, everybody. It's always a privilege to be at an AA meeting. It's always an honor to be asked to talk. When I was called, asked to come down here and talk, I said, well, I know Conway, Arkansas, because I know Robert. And, Robert is one of God's great gifts to Margaret. So that she can learn to practice tolerance and patience in all of her affairs. And I thought, well, that's all I know about Conway, except that when we were talking, Butch says, you'll recognize when you get off the plane because I'm a policeman. I'll be in a policeman's uniform, and I'll be wearing shorts. And I thought, oh, my God. Got Robert the sissy cop down there in Conway. I thought, well... Yeah, that sounds like my kind of town, you know. Why not? Let's go. You know, it's a lot like Mayfield, Kentucky. That's where I was born and raised. But it was delightful having dinner with y'all tonight. It really was delightful. Although I got to tell you, Patsy is just delightful. When I got up to get my second plate, you know, Butch is being real nice about it, not saying anything about him. In fact, I'm a pig, but he's just kind of accepting it. She said, you're such a little guy to be eating so much. in that sweet drawl of hers, you know, and I thought, what a delightful lady. I want to thank the committee and all the people who are responsible for getting me here, and I appreciate the basket. John, I think they got our rooms mixed up. I really do, because I had two people come to my room thinking they were looking that you would be there, and I got two baskets. And I know your wife isn't here. My wife's sick, too, so I'm sorry for that. I hope everything's going to be all right. And when I talk with you, I'll ask you what's going on. But I may have one of your baskets, I think, is what it is. Oh. That's one of the... What he said is she'll be at my room later on. This program really does work. Yeah. What time do you think she says she is? I'll meet her at the plane if you want me to. I was down in Beaumont, Texas not too long ago talking at a conference, and I tell this story because it's an alcoholic story. I love this story. The guy that was the voice of the conference is about 85 years old and just sharp as a tack, but he talks in a monotone type of voice that makes you think he's probably got a flat brainwave, but if you listen to him real close, he's funny. Funnier than a rubber crutch. The guy is really funny. And so I got to listen to everything he would say, and he told this wonderful story about this guy that y'all may know who I'm talking about this guy that traveled in East Texas, and he was on a circuit ride, and he was a salesman, and he'd go into one town for one week and then do his business and go to another town for another week, and every time he'd check into this one motel in East Texas or in each town he was in, they'd set him up because they knew he was going to be drinking, and they'd just set him up for the whole week. Right. Now comes the dancing, right? Is this thing just come on all of a sudden? Could y'all hear me from the back when I was started? I'll go over it again if you'd like. Can we do that? In any event, he said, so this one night he left this particular town, and he just had, like a lot of us alcoholics, he'd had all this fun he could tolerate. So he went home and got into Alcoholics Anonymous. So they didn't know this, obviously. He rode the circuit and came back into the same town that night. He checked into the same motel, got ready for his week's work there, and got out and went to supper the next night. And they thought he was going out to get drunk like he always did, so they had everything set up for him. He comes back in, opens the room to his door, or the door to his room, and he walks in. Here sits these two beautiful women on the end of his bed, naked. And there's a fifth of whiskey sitting on the table beside the bed. He sat there, and he looked at those women, and he looked at that whiskey, and he said, well, I want y'all to know I've just joined AA. And they told me that if I wanted to be happy, and if I wanted to stay sober, I had to quit drinking and change everything I'm doing. So I can't drink that whiskey. And one of you girls is going to have to leave. Is that not enough? Half measure is going to avail him something, right? I love that story. That's the alcoholic. That's the way I've lived my life. You know, half measure. You know, one of you girls is going to have to leave. The What I'm going to tell you tonight, and I need to clear this up real quick, because I'm not going to tell you that what I'm going to say is the only way, the right way, or the best way to recover. I'm going to tell you about me. Some of you have traveled the journey I've traveled. Some of you haven't begun it yet. Some of you have gone a lot further along. Some of you will sit there and listen to me talk and think, well, I'll be glad when he gets to this point in time. And some of you will sit there and say, how in the hell did he ever get there? And when this talk's over, I'll be here for the rest of the weekend. I do have to leave early Sunday, and I'm sorry, but those are just the connections I had to make. It's the first time I've ever missed any of the speakers that I can remember during the period of time that I've been so-called circuit speaking, but I simply have to leave early because of those are my connections. But I will be around. And if you want to come up and talk to me, please do. And I really welcome it, because there may be some things that I just don't explain very well or share very well, and ask me about them. There may be some things that you want to tell me that I need to hear. And that's what this program's all about for me, is we will share if you will not be intimidated by me and if I'll not be intimidated by you, and we can talk about some of the things that I've talked about and some of the things you may like to talk about. I'm a doctor. And I've been in family practice. I retired about a year and a half ago from the practice of medicine to become chairman of the Impaired Physicians Committee for the state of Kentucky. I travel all over the state of Kentucky educating physicians about how to recognize what we've got and most of all how to treat us. My 15 years of recovery and my last 10 years of intensive study of our disease, which is nothing more than an enhancement of what Dr. Silkworth said in the doctor's opinion, physical allergy and mental obsession, is beginning to pay off. God has sent me down this path, and as long as he chooses to leave me here, I'll continue to do it. But during that 25 years of practicing family medicine, I found one thing. There are multiple diseases, and the combination of all of them doesn't even come close to approximating the devastation of the disease of alcoholism. Doesn't even rank a close second. Alcoholism takes no prisoners. It leaves nothing to anybody who's either afflicted or affected. What I have found in this treatment of alcoholism in my own and in the people who touched me in a professional capacity, the only power that's strong enough to deal with that disease, that devastating disease of alcoholism, is the power of love. Is the power of love. When I was a little boy in Western Kentucky in Mayfield, I used to rock in that little swing in kindergarten and Sunday school, and they'd say to me, God is love. God is love. And when I came to you people, I was so devastated and so wiped out and basically physically so cognitively ripped that I couldn't even understand what the third step meant. I couldn't even feel it. I wanted to. I've heard people sit around in their first year of recovery and say, the third step. Well, many times physically, it's impossible to grasp that abstract. It's just simply a matter, at least in my case, of saying, God is love. And the peace that came to me from that was just indescribable and unmeasurable. The absolute power of love. We see it and feel it in this room, and we've all experienced it who've been around even for a few hours. About 10 years ago, I started into a syndrome that seems to affect people between 10 and 15 years of recovery. I became absolutely convinced that AA was on very tenuous grounds, that probably it wasn't going to survive. Not only did I begin to feel that way, I really felt that God had given me the absolute mandate to get it straightened out. It was absolutely imperative that I get busy and get AA on its feet before it just self-destructed. I was up in Santa Fe. I met a fellow in Dallas, and it turns out he moved to Santa Fe, and I was up in Santa Fe talking with him, and he, since that time, has died. And I asked him one day, I said, this is about 4 years ago, I said, you think AA's in trouble? How long do you think? He'd been sober about 32 or 33 years. And he looked at me, he said, well, let me tell you what I know about that. He said, I don't know whether it is or not. He said, it's okay for me right now. He said, but when Bill Wilson gave one of his last talks, they rolled him out on the stage literally with all of his oxygen stuff going at the time. And someone asked from the audience, they said, Bill, how long do you think AA will be here? And he said, as long as God wants it to be. Took a hell of a load off me. I got to tell you, it really took a hell of a load off me about that time. I got real relaxed about things about that time. I asked Geraldine D., who's been sober about 50 years, runs a treatment center up in New Jersey, and I don't know, John, if you know her, but she's such a delightful lady. Corey, you may know her, too. And she's such a delightful lady. And I asked her about 5 years ago, I said, Geraldine, Ms. D., I said, because that's what I would want to call her, is Miss D. I said, is AA different today than when you came in? She didn't hesitate. She said, yes. I said, what's different? She said, when I came in, there were always at least 20 old-timers for every newcomer. Today there's about 50 newcomers for every old-timer. And I said, what's the solution? She said, each of us who have become old-timers must maintain purity with the principles and walk them that way and teach them to those people who want to hear them. I'm in two big book studies a week, one of which I teach and one of which I'm a participant in, and this is the way we're reaching the greatest number of newcomers. I still believe in sponsorship. I still have a sponsor. I still sponsor as many people as I can sponsor and be there for them. But the masses, the principles of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm absolutely convinced for those of us who are well-grounded in them and who live them, we're going to have to not only show them by the way we walk, we're going to have to talk them too. That is my opinion and that is my experience. In Beaumont at that time, I came to realize that the face of AA is changing, the principles are not. You know the picture we see in almost every AA clubhouse where it shows the two men with their suits on sitting beside the bed making the 12-step call on the guy sitting there in his T-shirt? That was the face of AA. It is the face of AA. When I was in Beaumont, I was a Saturday night speaker, and I got up Saturday morning to do my regular meditation in preparation for establishing today's spiritual condition for me. On the nights that I'm talking, I usually do a little different in the mornings. And that particular morning, I was up at about 7 o'clock, and I looked out on the pool, and there are two little girls. I call them little girls. They're about 15. Sitting beside that pool, only two people out there. They had a table beside them with a big book that was open. They were in chairs facing each other, and they were holding each other's hands like that. And you would see that one of them's lips move, and then the other one's lips move, and then they would both turn, and you'd see them turn the pages, and then they'd turn back around, and they would hold each other's hands. And that is the new face of AA. Two little girls reading the same principles, holding hands, loving each other. The principles never change, do they? God is love. Walk with love. Since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous, I found very few things that have not changed at all. They have been absolute constants in my recovery. The first thing that has not changed is that I'm constantly changing. I'm constantly changing. You know, that's it. If you heard a talk of mine 10 years ago or 5 years ago, you'll hear some of the same lattice work, but if I'm following this journey, you're not going to hear some all the same things. You're going to hear some different things, some more in-depth things. What I have found is that people have said to me, this constant changing are different plateaus of growth. Well, I can't relate to different plateaus of growth. I understand it, but I can't relate to it. What I do relate to are different plateaus of surrender, where I've literally surrendered to the unmanageability of life and God's absolute power and my powerlessness. I kept, boom, hit the wall, bloody my nose. Boom, hit the wall, bloody my nose. Get up and I'd shake my head and look around. Nobody else's nose was bloody, just mine. And finally, one day, I became aware of God's absolute power. I used to hear people, old-timers, when I came in the program, they'd say, somebody got drunk, and they'd say, well, he just didn't understand, or he couldn't accept the first step. And I used to think they meant powerlessness over alcohol. As I've gone through sobriety, what I found out is they really did not understand or even relate to or accept the second half of the first step, the unmanageability of life. You know, my solution to a lot of problems is when I can't get the square peg in the round hole, and that's many times a fourth and fifth step. I've done fourth and fifth steps so my guts would fly out and I couldn't get any relief. So my solution to get that square peg in that round hole was just get a bigger hammer. Do more, do more, do more, do more. Drive that square peg in that round hole. You know? Just drive that square peg in that round hole. And now I got to the sixth and seventh step. And I could lay my hammer down. What I was found out was hitting those different plateaus of surrender to God's absolute power. He sent a message back to me through you that I had a responsibility. I got impaled on page 449 and the third step of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean impaled on them. I gave everything to God and accepted the fact that that's the way it is. Well, maybe if you put your pants on, you wouldn't be walking naked down Main Street, you know. God didn't put your pants on. Put your damn pants on yourself, you know. Why do they keep putting me in jail? Because I'm naked. Well, put your pants on. Oh, right. You know, not drinking is good. But Bill Wilson used to say, good can be the enemy of the best. I walked 8.5 years in this program with 3 1/3-step program. A 3 1/3-step program, figure it out. I took more drunks of treatment than you can count. I didn't notch my belt on. That's just what I was told to keep me sober, and it did help me a hell of a lot. But 8 years in this program, 8.5 years in this program, with a 3 1/3 step program, I was goofier than a snake. Just goofier than a snake. My message to you, based on my experience, if you want it all, go do it. There are 12 steps. If you want it all, go do it. And some of it, I just had to work my butt off for. God's power and my work. And if there's a key balance in my program today, it's that balance of God's power and my work, one day at a time, for the whole joy. For the whole joy. Second thing that has not changed in my program is I'm powerless over alcohol. From the first day I walked in this program, I was powerless over alcohol. Alcohol whipped me. It left me nothing. It absolutely devastated. Oh, I had fine houses and drove fine cars. Nothing. I was hollow. Absolutely hollow. Worse, I felt nothing. I felt nothing. Now, I took amphetamine for 12 years from 1958 to 1970 with no alcohol. I quit taking amphetamine in 1970 because it was messing up my life. I didn't think I was powerless over it. Never even considered that as an option. It just was messing up my life. So I quit. I drank alcohol for 8 years and was in the same sewer even further down. And I quit drinking alcohol the day I pulled a shotgun out of my mouth because alcohol whipped me. I didn't care about whether it was messing up my life. I didn't care what I was going to gain or lose. I just wanted the dignity of not having to get drunk. And all that went with it, it whipped me. When I've listened to people in meetings say, well, I'm not sure I'm an alcoholic, I say, God, I know it takes what it takes. It did for me and it will for them. But if they are an alcoholic of my type, please let them accept the fact that they're powerless over alcohol. Because the road gets rocky and the pain gets worse. The third thing that has not changed for me since I walked into this program is it would take a power greater than me to restore me to sanity. Now, it took a power greater than me to restore me to sanity from the insanity of drinking. See, I'm an alcoholic. As far as alcohol is concerned, I'm playing two sandwiches short of a picnic. I don't care how long and how well I work these steps, I ain't ever going to be able to go back and drink like a normal person. So I don't want anybody to lose sight of that. I am powerless over alcohol, and I ain't like normal people are in regard to alcohol. And I was insane from drinking, and it took that power greater than me to restore me to sanity from the insanity of drinking. But when I quit drinking, I was left with the real problem. Me. Book says self-centeredness. Me. And it's taken a power greater than me to restore me to sanity from the insanity of sobriety. Because I've done as many dumb things sober as I did drunk, and the only excuse I had was my self-centeredness. 2 years ago, I was walking down the hall of my office. Have you ever had a day when you just had your belly full of yourself? You know, you just had your belly full of yourself. Think, my God, I got to be better than that. You know, that's dumb. Well, that day I just had my belly full of myself. The whole crisis had been created. My office manager didn't get the chart up. My nurse didn't bring the chart back. I got in the office in to see the patient about an hour late. She just ripped me up one side and down the other and should have. And I sat there and took it thinking, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, what's your will? God count to 5 again, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And I finally walked out of the door and did the only thing I could do. I called both the girls back in my office and fired them. That's, you know, it's logical. Yeah. And I sat there and I thought, my God, man, how long have I got to put up with this insatiable ego? Just how long? You know, 10 steps said, each day we'll face self-centeredness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. What do we do? We ask God to remove it. We talk to somebody. We make our amends, and we help somebody. This program is real simple. This program is real simple. You know, they wrote it so it would work for somebody with a 55 IQ or a rocket scientist. I'm telling you. The problem I found is it just takes the rocket scientist longer to get a hold of it. And some of us pseudo-rocket scientists get in a real big lot of trouble. But the program's real simple. So I went in there and did it, called my sponsor, we talked about it, went out and called the girls back, hired them back there, told them I'm sorry, they're still waiting. I did the same thing 6 months before, so they know I'm coming back, I'm going to do it. Right. And we get to the meeting after my home group, which is the men's meeting at Trinity, and closed discussion. And one of the guys said, anybody had trouble staying away from a drink today or staying away from their own self-centeredness? Got your head up your butt? You want to talk about it? What's going on, you know? I said, yeah, I'd like to talk a minute. I said, what's the matter? I said, how long have I got to deal with this insatiable ego? One of the guys sitting there is about my age, had been in the program about 2 years, and I sponsored him for the first year, and he's really doing real well in the program. And he raised his hand. He said, "Well, Vern," said, "I don't know how long you got to deal with your insatiable ego, but you taught me you just got to do it for today." You know, you raise them and they come up and bat you right in the butt. Just like that. Isn't that the beauty of AA, you know? Yeah. There are no gurus, Nate. Those of us who try to be gurus, the group conscience doesn't allow it to happen for very long. You know, tonight's guru may not be able to pick his nose up, threatening his brain. That's just the way it is. And when we close tonight, we'll all hold hands in a circle. All equal. Saying the Lord's Prayer. Now, we'll tell you how I deal with that insatiable ego on a daily basis. Because somebody once said to me, "Why didn't you explain what you do with it?" Well, I'll tell you what I do with it. Okay, I get up in the morning. I do the 11-step prayer the way it's written in the big book. I do the 3rd-step prayer the way it's written in the big book. I do the 7th-step prayer the way it's written in the big book. Then there are sections out of the big book that I have found that have become very important to me in the last 3 years, and they are the sections on tolerance and patience and tolerance and love. Because that's a real problem for me. I'm not only am I intolerant of you, I'm intolerant of me. And there are wonderful references throughout the book for tolerance and patience. And I do that. I execute my day with the 10th step, which leads me to all the other steps, and I close it with the 11-step closure. Just the way it's written. For me, that pseudo-rocket scientist that keeps it real simple. What I've noted by doing that is the road has narrowed and the horizon has broadened unmeasurably. I have a way to keep sane and between the curbs. It's called the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Just the way they're written. With the beauty that has come with the constant change. I've added a couple of things, and one I've added today is I close each morning by saying, "Dear God, today don't let me do anything to hurt me, and don't let me do anything to hurt anybody else." It's very important that I not do anything to hurt me, because you know who pays for it first? Whoever's in mouth shot, or whoever's in the shot where they can see my countenance, where I walk around with my lips stuck out, and they're saying, "Wonder if he's pissed at me, you know." I never tell you. I just let you guess. Not one of y'all have ever done that. I understand. I can see that by the way you're reacting. What's he talking about? Well, if you've been around longer than 2 days, you know damn well what I'm talking about. Eventually, it'll get to me when I work these steps. But you pay first. Don't let me do anything to hurt myself. Don't let me do anything to hurt anybody else. Alcoholism has been called a disease. Let me tell you something. I gave a talk in southern Indiana one night, right across the river from Louisville. And I normally didn't go to this meeting. I knew most of the people in that meeting, but I went over there to talk at a birthday, and I go over there about twice a year and talk at a birthday, and when I came in the back door, they knew I was going to talk. Somebody said, "Hey, Burns, you talking that?" And I said, "Yeah." And they said, "Well, keep it honest and keep it short." And I said, "Well, I'm not sure I can do both." And they said, "Then keep it short." Well, I need to tell you that, because this talk ain't going to particularly be short, but it is going to be honest. And those of you whose butt gets to the point where your brain won't tolerate it, please, you can get up and leave. I'm going to finish this talk. That's how it is. It's not because of arrogance. It's just because there's so many things that's happened in my life. And I try not to be real mouthy and real windy, but sometimes I get that way. And I try not to preach and teach, and sometimes I get that way, too, and I don't really mean to. But alcoholism has been called a disease of perception. I know Clancy said that. What I relate to that is, what the big book says, is the peculiar mental twist. To me, that means more to me than disease of perception. I know what disease of perception means. It means I can take Margaret and turn her into anything I want to turn her into to enable me to do anything I want to do, which is a peculiar mental twist which enables me to get a drink of whiskey sometime. And that's the peculiar mental twist of the disease of perception. Now, my recovery was also a difference in perception. I'm going to tell you a joke about perception. Any of y'all who heard me talk in the last 10 years have heard this joke. But I tell it because it's a wonderful joke. Some of you may not have heard it, and I tell it exceptionally well. It's a great joke. It's a great joke. This has to do with perception. Now, I don't know anything about flying, but so give me a little poetic license. Here's a pilot sitting at 10,000 feet. The ceiling's 100 feet off the ground. The tower says you've got one chance to land that plane when you come through that ceiling. So put that plane on that runway one time, and that's it. If you don't make it that first time, man, you're history. You don't have to do it. You can go somewhere else. And he said, "No, I can do it." He said, "All right, remember, stop it." So he comes down through that 100-foot ceiling, puts that plane on that runway, throws on the brakes, the tires squeal, and the smoke comes up off the tires. The nose of the plane gets right over the edge of the runway and just shivers and just settles down. Pilot's just sitting there sweating to beat hell. He turns around to the co-pilot and he says, "I believe that's the shortest runway I've ever seen." Co-pilot's sitting there just sweating. He looked at him and he said, "Yeah, but did you notice how wide it is?" I love that joke. I just love it. And if God's willing, and don't get Alzheimer's, I'll still be telling that sucker 30 years from now. And Robert, if I do, send me a tape to remind me of it, would you? Anyway, so my recovery was, they had a common problem, common solution, but different perception of the whole deal. I grew up in a little town in western Kentucky named Mayfield. I grew up in a home where there was no alcohol and there were no drugs. My grandfather died drinking lye water in the Mayfield City Jail. My mother was molested physically, emotionally, and sexually in that home. She dragged the whole disease of alcoholism into our home. She was a lovely lady, one of the kindest, sweetest ladies I've ever known, but ripped with rage and resentment and fear and shame. You know, if you read the family afterward, it tells you that if any of you people are around us, and what it says simplistically stated is, if y'all are around us very long, you get goofy. And that's just the way it was. Mama was goofy. Delightful lady, but goofy. And the way it came out in Mama was conditional love. If I was perfect, she talked to me. If I wasn't perfect, she didn't. So I solved that problem. I became perfect. Now, if you'd have seen my list of accolades in high school and college, you'd have thought that maybe one day I'd be president of the United States, but never an alcoholic. Alcohol and drugs were no problem. I entered medical school. Now, I don't know about y'all, but all of my life I've had a motor running in me. Can y'all relate to it? Like there's a wind blowing through or something's going on. You ain't quite sure what's going on. All the way from they're talking about me, there's anybody talking, period, but it's always been a motor. Get to A, get to B, get to C, get back to D. What'd you miss? A, go big, B, D, C, A, you know, just like that. Boom, just like that, motor. Now, one of the ways that came out, Big Book calls it irritable, restless, discontented. I mean, that's what the Big Book says. Now, the way it came out in medical school was 100 people were in that class. Dean walked out, and he looked around, and he said, there are 100 of you in this class, only 75 of you will graduate. I don't care for 100 A's, the last 25 A's will flunk. Look at the guy next to you, he may not be here next year. And I turned to look at him, and that sucker was looking right back at me. And I thought, oh, my God, I'm not going to make it. You know, what I really felt was 99 of those people looked like they ought to be doctors. There was one who didn't think he should be. Me. You know, you people all look like you got your act together. And I know you so well, like you know me. I know you don't. But you still look like you got your act together. And every crowd looks like it's got its act together. And I always felt like I didn't even need to even be in the crowd, much less in front of it. I was flying apart, literally couldn't study, couldn't sleep, couldn't do anything, and after 2 weeks I just packed my clothes to come home. This is a kid with a straight A average in high school and a straight A average in college who did not feel he could do it. As I was leaving school, one of my classmates came up and gave me a little capsule called amphetamine speed and said, take this, it'll help you study. And I took that amphetamine and the motor stopped. The motor just stopped. I found four things that always stopped my motor and they worked every time. Amphetamine, alcohol, sex, and AA. AA works better. It just takes longer. But you know, not one time in AA have they put me in jail for going to AA. And not one time have I gotten a divorce since I've been in AA. And I did all those things on amphetamine, alcohol, and sex. Jail and divorce. You know? But my motor stopped and I could study and I could read and I could sleep and I found the whole answer to life. Everybody in medical school took amphetamines that time. Everybody else quit. I did not. 2 weeks before graduation, my senior year in 1962, I was kicked out of medical school in an amphetamine rage. I beat up one of my medicine professors. They came and took me to the head of the Department of Psychiatry, and Dr. Keller looked at me and said, what's wrong with you, Burns? And I said, I take too many drugs. And he said, do you believe that? And I said, yes, sir. And he said, we can help you. And I said, please do. What are you going to do? And he said, we're going to put you in intensive psychiatric therapy. If you can figure out why you take that drug, you can quit. You're going to think yourself into a way of acting. You're going to, their perception of my recovery is you're going to think yourself into a way of acting. Now, it makes sense. It's called cognitive thinking or cause and effect thinking. We lead our daily lives by it. The reason we don't get hit by buses is because we don't step out in the front of them. You can sit there and say, here comes a bus. God, don't let that bus hit me, and step out and the bus runs over you. You think, my God, why'd you let it hit me? And God says, why don't you go back there and ask that guy standing beside you if you ought to step out in front of that bus? You know, it works that way every day. You know? God says, no, I don't think you ought to step out in front of that damn bus. But cognitive cause and effect thinking. Now, I'm not anti-psychiatry, neither was the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, neither was the Big Book. Two psychiatrists had a significant amount of input into our program, Harry Thibault and Carl Jung. Bill Wilson was great friends with Harry Thibault and had a communication relationship with Carl Jung, and they were major contributors to our entire program. I'm anti-ignorance in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, where I see a lot of people practicing medicine who don't have degrees. I'm anti-ignorance in the medical profession because they are too arrogant to learn how to treat us. And God has allowed me to be with both of you people and to say the things I'm able to say from my experience and from my strength and from my hope and my knowledge. And I think I have had an impact helping alcoholics not to practice medicine and helping doctors learn how to treat us. But I'm not anti-psychiatry. Psychiatry taught me how to identify a feeling. Didn't keep me sober and didn't keep me off drugs, but it taught me how to identify a feeling. They brought me knowledge. When I came to you 15 years later, you stuck it in a fourth step, strung it out through the rest of the steps, and gave me a spiritual solution. And then I could be happy, joyous, and free. After 2 years of not taking any drugs, Dr. Keller looked at me and said, "We're going to let you back into medical school. How do you feel?" And I said, "I'm afraid." And he said, "Why are you afraid?" And I said, "Because they're going to be watching me." He said, "Why should they be watching you?" And I said, "Because I whipped one of them." And he said, "No, okay, so they should be watching. You should be afraid. That's a reasonable feeling. Now you can own the feeling. The feeling won't have to own you, and you won't have to take drugs over it. Does that make sense?" And I thought, "Yes, it makes sense." So I went back into medical school all fired up, and within 30 minutes I strung out on amphetamine. I went right straight down to the OBGYN clinic because we used to keep stacks of it. We gave it to women who were pregnant at that time to cut down on their appetite. It was not as controlled drug as it is today. I knew exactly where to get it, and I was strung out within less than 15 to 30 minutes and just sat on the steps and cried because I didn't know why. My classmates enabled me that year. They put me to bed, take me home. I was married and had one small child. She called the medical school and told them I had the flu. They knew better, but they didn't know what else to do. I did graduate from medical school, and the next 4 years I was in Our Lady of Peace, the mental hospital, four times, strapped down, IV fluid, straight jackets, padded cells, the whole bit. Went in the Army in 1967, and they gave me a key to the pharmacy. That's like putting a fox in a chicken house. Post commander came down after 1 year and looked at me and said, "Are you taking the amphetamine?" And I said, "Yes, sir." And he said, "If you don't quit, we'll put you in Leavenworth." And I quit because he explained it to me. I had a choice. I could quit. And I could still quit. I came home in 1969, got back on amphetamine again, and had a gallbladder attack, and they put me in the hospital, took my gallbladder out, and a good friend of mine came down and looked at me and said, "Burns, you're a good doctor and a good man. Please quit taking amphetamine. It's killing you." So I quit. My last amphetamine was 1970. Then I started drinking. 4 years I drank that was not alcoholic. I might get drunk, I might stay sober, but I didn't set out to get drunk. I didn't set out to stay sober. I didn't just go to restaurants that only served alcohol. I didn't just run with people who only drank. It was not an obsession. The last 3 years I drank alcoholically, or the next 3 years. If you didn't drink, we didn't run together. If restaurants didn't serve alcohol, I didn't go. I knew exactly how much I could drink and go to a football game and make it home, how much I could drink, go to a party and make it home, how much I could drink and not make it home. I knew exactly what it would do, and it was a daily obsession. Then the last year I drank addictively. I drank a quart of whiskey a night. And told myself I was not an alcoholic because I never drank in my office. The delusion was complete. The pain wasn't over yet, but the delusion was complete. Somewhere between Thanksgiving and December of 19 and first of 1977, I was living with Casey, Margaret and Robert, knowing some of you other people know Casey, and she's one of God's greatest gifts to me, and she truly is. My first marriage had ended very bitterly. The divorce took quite a while. It took almost 2 years. And Casey and I moved in. I ran real hot and chased women, drank a lot of whiskey for about a year and a half, and then met Casey and knew that she was exactly what I'd never had in my life. And we got together and started living together. When I realized I was going to run her off if I didn't quit drinking, I decided I'd switch to other drinks. So my drink of choice was scotch and water. So I switched to beer, I switched to wine, I switched to martinis. One day I drank 24 martinis and couldn't get drunk. Next day I drank a bottle of beer and couldn't get out of bed for 2 days. So I didn't know what he was going to do. She'd gone to work that morning, and I sat in a chair looking out. And I said, "God, I don't know what to do." I'd reached it, and I remember sitting in that chair looking out that thing, and I said, "God, I don't know what to do." I thought, "I know what I'll do. I'll smoke dope." And I thought, "Why would you do that? It won't work for you. You took amphetamine for 12 years, and it damn near killed you. Then you quit amphetamine, took another drug, alcohol, for 8 years, nearly killed you. For reasons you don't understand, mood-altering drugs don't work in you. None of them work like they would in normal people. I can take an Actifed today and go over and sit in that corner and count my toes for about 4 hours. And I don't ever get 10, and I don't care. You know, it just doesn't matter to me." And that may sound funny to you, but it really doesn't matter to me. I did 8, 7, 12, on 1 foot. And But I thought, I can't smoke dope. I don't know why it doesn't treat me like it does other people, but I can't. And I realized I couldn't live with it. I didn't know these words, what the book says. I couldn't live with it. I couldn't live without it. I thought, I know why. I just won't do anything. And I thought, you can't live in this world without something in you. You never have and you never will. That's what I thought. Totally hopeless and totally helpless. I said, God, please help me. And it dawned on me what to do. And I went back, and the relief was instant. I walked back, sat in my bedroom, loaded my shotgun, put it in my mouth. I was ready to die. And the relief at dying was wonderful. The fear of living was overpowering. Someone asked me why I did not kill myself, and I'll tell you why I didn't kill myself. It took me a number of years to understand why. And I did not know it until I had this in AA. I did not pull that trigger because there was no dignity. If there is one thing I have found that is consistent in recovery, it is dignity. We walk with dignity. As God's people, we stand on our feet. We don't crawl before anybody. If we're sensible, tactful, considerate, and humble. Dignity. Dignity. And I didn't pull that trigger because I did not have dignity. I crawled to the phone and picked up the phone and called a friend of mine who's a psychiatrist, and I said, David, please help me. And he asked me to come to his office, which was beside Our Lady of Peace. And I said, David, what have I got to do? And he said, you got to go in the hospital. And I looked at Our Lady of Peace and I said, I've been in there 4 times. It never works. David, I don't want to go into the hospital. But I said the thing that was to begin my journey. I said, I'll do anything you tell me to do. I became teachable. I quit negotiating. I quit arguing. I quit bargaining. I said, I'll do anything you tell me to do. He said, you don't have to go in that hospital. He sent me to a psych hospital in New York for 2 weeks, transferred me to an alcohol treatment center in Atlanta for a month, put me in a halfway house for 3 months, 2 to 3 months, and then I came home and got with you people in AA. When I walked into you people, I just wanted to know what y'all had and what could you tell me to do. I said, what have I got to do to stay sober and be happy? And you said, anything we tell you to do, you're going to act yourself into a way of thinking. See the difference? You're going to act yourself into a way of thinking. The profundity of Alcoholics Anonymous amazes me. It fascinates me, the profundity of it. They intuitively knew from their experience, even before there was knowledge, that we are playing with sawdust for brains for about 2 years. We've got to act ourselves into a way of thinking because we can't find the commode on a given day, you know? And they knew it. They knew it. I said, well, okay, I'll do anything you tell me to do. What do you want me to do? And you said, don't drink, go to meetings, and read the big book. Never changes. And simplicity. I'm one of these people that I'm just like you, and you know it. I can take a plate of spaghetti that's all screwed up and play with it for about 10 minutes and have it in a bigger mess than when it started. So don't drink, go to meetings, and read the big book. Somebody said, he's going to give us the truth. I am giving you the truth. Don't drink, go to meetings, and read the big book. I had somebody one time as a circuit speaker say, why do you tell people that? That's not the way it's written down. And I said, I'm just telling them that's what worked in my life. Don't drink, go to meetings, and read the big book. So I'd sit there and I'd think, they talk about not drinking. They just beat that to death. Don't drink, don't drink. They just talk about it all the time. Don't drink. I know not to drink. Why do they do that? I stuck a tape of Sandy Beaches in one day, and he said, every time he got drunk, it was a direct result of drinking. And I remember thinking, the man's a genius. He's got this whole damn thing figured out. And I thought it was my ex-wife and being born poor and all this kind of stuff. You know, no. He said, if you don't want to get drunk, don't drink. Real simple. Okay, don't drink. All right, don't drink. Go to meetings. Now, let me tell you a little bit about meetings. I'm going to reflect for y'all on 15 years and what meetings have meant for me. Let me take you back to that little home in Mayfield. I was a junior in high school. And I came in one night after a football game, and I'd had one bottle of beer. Made me sick. Walked in the living room, sat down, threw up. Daddy came in, looked at me, and he said, Burns Mac, you've been drinking. And I said, yes, sir, I've had one beer. And so we talked for a while, and he said, you're right, you're not drunk. And I said, no, sir, I'm just sick. He said, well, here, let me help you clean this mess up, and you go on upstairs, and we'll talk about it in the morning. Now, remember this little mother of mine who had been molested physically, emotionally and sexually. They had an interesting way of treating alcoholics in Mayfield in the middle 30s. They put them in jail, and when they sobered up, they put them in chain gangs, and they swept the Mayfield City streets in chain gangs. And my mother used to walk past her daddy at least once a month in a chain gang sweeping the Mayfield City streets. The shame the rage. And I was the first son. I was the great hope that was going to take the Crossland Bradys out of that alcoholic quagmire. And here was her great hope, this perfect kid of hers, who had had a beer. And as I turned to walk out of the living room and go upstairs, living room was here, went upstairs, Mama's bed and Daddy's bedroom was right here, and as I started up those stairs, Mama just came running out, grabbed me by the hair of the head and said, "You little bastard, wop, 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 I'll never talk to you again." It took me about 4 or 5 fourth steps and fifth steps and 8 years of psychiatric therapy to ever even admit how I felt. I certainly wouldn't have said it in that home I was born and raised in, because my daddy would have cleaned my clock, and I've always been real grateful that I was born and raised in a home that had that kind of discipline and that kind of respect. But what I felt was, "And you bitch, I'll never trust you again." And when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't trust the one of you either. I'd been the deacon in 5 churches and 8 years of psychiatric therapy, and if AA didn't have the answer, I was dog meat. I had nowhere else to go, but I didn't trust a one of you. And what I found out is AA is a perfect program, and there are an awful lot of us you can't trust. When I did my first fifth step, they might as well put it on the first page of the Courier Journal the next day, because it was all over hell and half of Georgia within about 15 minutes. Big Book's very specific about this, very specific in the fifth step, in the first part of the sixth chapter, about confidentiality. When I came into the program, those of you who know my wife know she's a pretty little lady. And there were a number of people in AA, a bunch of guys trying to take her to bed. And I understood that. Didn't appreciate it, but I understood it. There were a bunch of them trying to take me to bed. And that really bewildered me, because whiskey whipped me. I had a big pot belly, little bitty arms, little skinny legs, and looked yellow as a damn gourd, and had a liver down on my iliac crest. And I mean, I was a mess. I didn't even want to go to bed with me. And here was these people trying to take me to bed, you know. There were people who wanted to borrow money, and they did, and didn't intend to pay it back, and they didn't. And this was real confusing to me. You know, I'm in this program full of love, and in this program full of trust, and this program full of honesty, and there are people jacking around everywhere, you know. And I thought, what in the hell is this all about? But I knew I had to stay. I had nowhere to go. So these people come and ask me to take them, you know, say, "I want to take you out to have coffee." And I'd say, "Why?" And they'd say, and winners would say, "Because we want to stay sober, and we want to help you stay sober." And I began to see people that had lights on inside their eyes. And I began to follow them, and I began to learn, and I began to trust. And I began to hear God's message. In all the clamor, I heard God's message. Principles over personalities. I've got people that I sponsor that go, "I'm never going back to that meeting. That soul be said, blah, 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 blah." And I say, "Well, hold my hand. We'll go back to the meeting. It's probably your fault, but he may not be. Maybe he's an idiot. We'll go back and see what's going on. If he's an idiot, we'll go to another meeting. But come on, let's go, you know." And the group conscience prevails. Principles over personality. Second thing I found out about them that don't go to meetings, don't hear what happens to them that don't go to meetings. Jim W. from down in Dallas one time said, when he came to the program, said he had hide and his sponsor would come get him and take him to a meeting. He said he'd hide and his sponsor would get him and take him to a meeting. He'd hide and his sponsor would get him and take him. He said, "One night I hid so well he couldn't find me." He said, next day he called me and said, "Well, you missed it, Jim." And he said, "What did I miss?" And he said, "Well, you didn't hear what you supposed to hear." And he said, "Well, what was it?" He said, "I don't know. I heard what I was supposed to hear, but you'll never know what you're supposed to hear." I've never walked out of a meeting that I didn't hear something I was supposed to hear. Sometimes and almost always I walk out of a meeting and what I've heard, I feel good, I feel great, I feel fulfilled, I feel sweet and serene and loving. Sometimes I walk out and I could bite a damn 10-penny nail in two. I think I'd like to stroke, just choke his testicles off, you know, whatever. I mean, just absolutely livid. And I think, "What's the message, God?" And I feel God say, "Go home and read the fifth chapter on resentment. That's what you got to do." You know, said, "He ain't going to get you drunk, but that resentment may." So I heard what I was supposed to hear, you see. Always hear something that I was supposed to hear. 8.5 years in this program, when I was driven to my knees and became an absolute student of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, put it into my head, into my heart, and I did it, and I live it today, I found out an awful lot about our disease. And in the chapter, There Is a Solution, it says the seminal fact of alcoholism and relapse. It says there will come a day, just memory with sufficient force, the humiliation of our last drink. We forget. What we say simply is the further you are from your last drink, the closer you are to your next one. You know, we say these simple little truths that we all need to hear.
I'm sitting there and I travel the country and I talk to doctors and I put all these formulas on the wall and they are just amazed. They say, is that alcoholism? I say, that's alcoholism. Well, why do you people ever drink again? I said, because we forgot what happened to us the last time we got drunk. They said, you've got to be kidding. It can't be that simple. But it is that simple. Sit in AA meetings and people say, it can't be that simple. Book says it. It's that simple. Every time I walk in that back door, I'm reminded of what I am. Through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, including a sponsor, the big book, a home group, meetings, the 12 steps, and a God of my understanding, it has been defined for me who I am. The day I forget what I am, you can take it to the bank, I will lose who I am. And I've crawled over the bodies of too many people not to know that. With tears in my eyes, learning from each one of them. And if I maintain that spiritual condition with an awareness of what I am and what you've taught me with God's grace as to who I am, I'm okay. I go to a lot of meetings today because that's where my friends are. That's where my friends are. That's where I want to be. And finally, I go to meetings today. You know why? Let me tell you. I don't want to miss the miracle. I don't want to miss the miracle. I used to lay on the floor of the Fontenay Apartments in Louisville drunk, and I screamed, God, show me a burning bush. He brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've got a whole room full of them. Every one of you are the burning bushes. Long before I could even feel it, or even today when I'm not aware of it, I watch burning bushes every day in this beautiful program. I work I go and work with men in a homeless shelter in Louisville. These people don't have anything else to lose. They just see the dignity of recovery in some of us who go down there and work with them. And I watch them rise like a phoenix out of absolute desperation of alcoholism. I see those men just want nothing more than the dignity. And I see the miracle. God, I wouldn't miss it for the world. Don't drink, go to meetings and read the big book. I sit down and I got the big book and I'd read it. I think that's beautiful, that's wonderful. And I'd close and I think, I can't remember it. I'd pick it up and I'd read it again and I'd close. I can't remember. I'd pick up my meditation book and read it and close. I'd pick up the Courage Journal and read it and close. And I couldn't remember. I'd come into an AME. I said, I can't remember anything. He said, hell, don't worry about it. None of us can. I said, well, how long does it last? About 6 months, 2 years. Did it get better? Yeah, it always gets better. I come in the next night and say, I can't remember anything. Because I forgot what you told me the night before, you know. I used to lose my car drinking all the time. I lost my car sober for the first 6 months that I was sober. I'd drive my car to work, go in, practice medicine, come out, get it, drive it home, drive it to work next day, practice medicine, get it going. One day I drove my wife's car, went in, practice medicine, came out, looked around, and I cried a lot in my first 6 months. And I was sitting there crying. I went in, and I said, Dave, that's my partner. I've lost. Somebody stole my car. And he came out, and he said, Burns, you drove Casey's car. And I said, oh, God, that's right. I forgot. So they assigned me a parking place. That's right. And they said, when Burns leaves the office, he's going to that parking place, and if he can get whatever's in it started, he's going to drive it home. Medical science studied us in 1975. They said the alcoholic will lose the power of retentive memory for 6 months to 2 years. Simple problem solving, stress management will be destroyed for 6 months to 2 years. Sleep patterns will be messed up for 6 months to 2 years. AA knew this in 1936. Now, I'm not putting medical science down. They prove that's the way we are. We prove it by every day we're in this program working with each other. I can see Dr. Bob and Bill. My mind gets weird sometimes. I can see Dr. Bob and... That's probably surprised y'all, right? I'm sitting there, Dr. Bob and Bill talking to each other, and Bob says to Bill, how do you feel? And Bill says, Bob, I feel great. And he said, well, how's your brain? He said, well, it ain't working too well. It's kind of like sawdust. Maybe we shouldn't make any major decisions for a year, you know? They knew it. Medical science studied it. So if any of y'all are in that first 2 years and you think you've messed up your brain, no, you haven't. Just stick around. It'll clear up. You'll be just like me. Said, don't let it hit. No, I take that back. You'd be like John or somebody else. Said, don't anybody go out and drink because they're afraid they'll be just like me when they grow up. Yeah. But stick around. When I talked at Bull Shoals, one of the first times I met Robert and Margaret, and I'm telling you, it's a wonderful conference. If you haven't been, please go out there in that great big tent. And I'm sitting there talking. I get this point, and there's a guy sitting back there about where you're sitting in that tent with a hat down over his eyes. He's sitting in a chair slouched down. You don't know whether he's going to shoot you or hug you when you get through talking. You know, he's like, I said, just stick around. Your brain's going to clear up. He came out of that chair like somebody had goosed him. He said, hallelujah, thank God I've lost my mind. I said, God, I know why you sent me down here to bull shows. I really, he followed me around that whole week. He said, Dr. Brady Belch, Dr. Brady broke wind. Anything I did, you know, he wrote it down because I knew the truth, you know. I had saved this guy's life. Don't drink, go to meetings and read the big book. Well, I thought, I can't read the big book. It won't work. I wonder how it works. Oh, God, how does it work? And so I picked up the big book because it said, you know, how it works. And I thought, if I go to where it says how it works, I see I was getting better. Maybe if I'm right there in that first paragraph, honesty, 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 three times, pow, 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 honesty. You want to know what's the cornerstone of this program? Honesty. Honesty. I talked at a meeting that night, and somebody said, oh, God, here comes Burns. He's going to talk about God and honesty. I know it's going to happen again. What else is there to talk about in this program except God and honesty? Said, there are those of us who may have grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of us do recover if we have the capacity to be honest. Those who don't make it are those who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. Wilson was talking about a small group of people, a very small group of people called sociopaths. They don't know the difference in honesty and dishonesty. I've had pigeons come to me and say, Burns, I think I'm constitutionally incapable of being honest with myself. And I said, no, you're not. That's not you. You're a liar. You know, there's a big difference. Don't confuse what's going on here, you know. Yeah, I mean, there it was. If you can be honest. I got it. When I went into treatment, I was drinking a quart of whiskey a night. And I asked to go into treatment. I sat in front of this guy running the treatment center. He looked at me and said, Burns, how much do you drink? I said, I drink a six-pack of beer every night. He said, you're lying. I said, I know it. I do it all the time. Why do I do that? I'd play golf that summer before I got in the program, and I'd hit my ball on the green. I'd go up there, and I'd put a dime in front of the ball. Then I go back and put the ball in front of the dime. I just saved myself a fourth of an inch on a 40-foot putt, and I hated my guts. I did it over and over. That summer I came back, I hit that ball on the green. I'd go up there and I'd put that dime behind that ball, and I'd put that ball back in front of that dime, and I'd walk off that green feeling good. I didn't know which direction the next hole was, but I felt real good. Somebody said, you ask Burns Brady anything, he'll tell you the truth. It may not have a thing to do with what you're talking about, but he'll tell you the truth every damn time. Couldn't stir pee, couldn't pour pee out of a boot, but I could tell the truth. And it made all the difference in the world to tell the truth. Somebody said, well, that sounds like cash register honesty. It sure as hell is cash register honesty. And it's as important to me today in my recovery as it was the first day I walked in this program. Never shortchange cash register honesty. And I feel like sometimes in meetings I hear people doing that. It says we must be honest with somebody. We're only as sick as our secrets. And our secrets, my secret, is when I know I'm not telling the truth. And the longer I've been sober, the easier it is to shave the edges. To shave the edges. I'm here to tell you it will gut you. If my experience means anything, if you don't tell the truth about everything in all of our affairs, it'll gut you. The last time it happened to me, it happened over a period of about 3 years. And it started when my wife went off to go to school and I decided that she wasn't doing things my way. I'd been sober 8 years. My nurse, who works next to me, was in the process of a very bad relationship with her husband, and I felt like it was necessary because she'd been with me for 2 years to help her with her problem. After a month of helping her with her problem in the office, I felt we should go to the Holiday Inn for breakfast so I could help her better with her problem. After 3 or 4 months of breakfast about every other morning, then it became imperative that we go to room 318 to further resolve her problem. As we got to the door and I put the key in the door at 318, I started screaming and crying, I do not want to get drunk. It ate my guts out. Because every step of the way I knew I was lying. I knew it. Now here somebody says, well, that sounds like cash. You bet your ass it is. And I'll guarantee you the people that have gotten drunk that I've worked with, they knew they were lying right up to the time they put that bottle to their mouth. And I got to tell you something about relationships. It may smell like a woman, but it's going to taste like whiskey. Hear the laughter? The girls will say, huh? The boys going, they're choking on it. You know? Said, no, we got to be honest with ourselves. Well, that's great. I do agree with that 100%. But there's a key part of step 10 that rings in my head. It says, alcohol is subtle. We are not cured of our alcoholism. What we have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. Alcohol is subtle. Clancy says it best. He's at 20,000 feet, 20 years sober, walking with God or flying with God. AA's below. And he said, God, how's AA doing? God says, it's doing fine, Clancy. He said, well, God, how am I doing? He said, you're doing fine, Clancy. I bet you could have a light beer. 2 years in the program, a young lady came up to me and she said, Burns, I want you to speak at my birthday. And I said, well, when is it? She said, it's next Tuesday. And I said, where are you going to have it? She said, at St. Thomas meeting. I said, that's my home group. That's the discussion meeting. She said, it's my birthday. I can do anything I want. And I said, let me go home and pray about it. I got home. I said, dear God, should we make this a discussion, a speaker meeting for Patty? Tell me, God, what should we do? Tell me what we should do. And I felt his voice say, make it a speaker meeting and you be the speaker. I called the guru of that meeting, who happened to be my sponsor. You know, all meetings have gurus. They sit at the front door and take inventories when people come in. Those are the gurus of me. I called Jim, and I said, Jim, we're going to have a speaker meeting at St. Thomas next Tuesday. He said, how'd you figure that out? And I said, I talked to God, and God said it's okay for Patty to have her birthday and for me to speak. And he said, I'll call you back in about 10 minutes. Call me back in about 10 minutes. He said, Burns, a strange thing has happened. There are five of us up here that go to that same meeting. He told me the word, and they're all good friends of mine, still are today. He said, we got in the back room and prayed about it. And he said, I don't understand this. He said, right now it looks like it's 5-1, the God of our understanding over the God of your understanding. to deal with the subtlety of alcoholism, I have a sponsor and a home group, and I go to meetings, and I read the big book, and I practice the 12 steps, and it takes every bit of that for me to deal with the subtlety of alcoholism. I have known the absolute pure inspiration of prayer, and I've known the total delusion of it. Prayer and share. Prayer and share. Prayer and share. Share the prayer. Share the prayer. I've got about 10 people in my life today that know as much about me as anybody on the face of this earth, and they know it all. They know when my breath stinks and I haven't even known that I've woke up yet. To deal with the subtlety of alcoholism. Big book of AA. If we stop the drinking, don't deal with the thinking, we go back to the drinking. 8 years in this program, when I really did become a student of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, 9 years later, I knew the true joy of walking a full 12-step program, and I said, dear God, please. You don't have to. I'm not irritated, but please, why did you leave me out there for 8.5 years? And listen to what I felt him say. He said, Burns, you've become an expert on alcoholism. You will lead by your knowledge. You will heal by your experience. I loved you so much, I wanted you to have this experience. Because there's some people in this room who are really squirrely tonight, and I know you are. It's because you've got a 3 1/3 step program too. All 12 steps in the big book. First year of my recovery was absolutely crazy. When I got to my first night, my first year token, I just sat there at the podium and I cried. And they said, how do you feel? I said, I don't know. And they said, are you happy? And I said, I don't know. And they said, are you glad to be here? I said, I don't know. And they said, do you want to drink? And I said, oh God, no, I don't want to drink. About a year and a half, all that began to clear. That so-called post-recovery syndrome began to clear. I started to get more brains instead of sawdust, and I became little Mr. AA. Get up on time, read your meditation, say your prayers, get to the office, call your sponsor, call your wife, meet your patients, see them on time, eat your lunch, call your sponsor, call your wife, get home in the evening, eat your supper, get to the meetings 30 minutes early, set up the coffee, set up the ashtrays, meet the newcomer, give him your number, stay 30 minutes late, talk to the newcomer, give him your telephone number, get his telephone number, get home in the evening, kiss your wife, go to bed, say your prayers, boom, 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 little Mr. AA. Can y'all relate to that? That's okay. At the end of the 11 steps, as alcoholics, we are undisciplined. We allow God to discipline us in this way, and I was learning a whole new way of living. I remember I used to talk to my sponsor in that first 5 years, and I'd say, what do you think are the psychological implications of my always being late in the morning? He'd say, why don't you get your ass up on time? I said, oh, yes. Oh, yes. A new concept. Then about 5 years in the program, I mean, I'm getting just rigid as hell. I'm just like this. I'm little Mr. Perfect Day. And the old-timers say, Burns, how you feeling? I say, I'm fine. This is a smile, you idiot. Can't you tell? I mean, just like this. I was down in South Georgia visiting a good friend of mine, an Episcopal priest, who was my spiritual director in AA. We don't talk about him much anymore, but I had a spiritual director as well as a sponsor. And he moved down to South Georgia with his wife, and Casey and I were down there seeing him. And I got back and dropped on my knees in the holiday, and I said, God, take away the pain. And Casey put her hands on my shoulder and said, call your sponsor. Now, my sponsor has a 2-step program, my first sponsor. And I tell you that not as a judgment, but as a report. One of God's greatest gifts to me. He had a 2-step program. I tell you that because I want you to hear what he said to me. I said, Jim, I'm flying apart. And he said, you're the most compliant person I've ever known. He said, do you think you'll ever get it? And I said, I don't know, Jim. I just want to be happy. I just want to relax. I started to hang up, and he said, "Burns, wait a minute." He said, "Let me ask you something." He said, "Do you think if you work these steps perfectly today, it'll make you good?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "You're wrong." He said, "Do you believe if you get drunk today, it'll make you bad?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "You're wrong." I said, "I don't understand." He said, "Burns, you've been trying to buy something that isn't for sale. It's given for fun and for free. God loves you just the way you are. He loves you drunk. He loves you sober. You're one of God's children." I started sobbing because all of my life I tried to be perfect. Perfect for Mama and she couldn't handle it. Perfect for me and I couldn't do it. Perfect for God and He didn't need it. I came to know what the parable of the prodigal son really is. It's not the drunk who comes home. It's not the brother who resents. It's the story of the father who waits. Spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection became a way of life for me at that time. God was getting ready to start me on another journey, and that journey for the next 3 years was to be able to love for fun and for free. All of my life I've taken hostages. Every alcoholic I've ever known takes hostages. Being in AA was no exception. My second greatest hostage was my first sponsor. I tricked him into making every decision for me. I was 50 years old, 8 years in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I never made a decision. I took every problem to him. He made the decision. I told him to the pigeons. 8 years sober and had never made a single decision for myself. Therapists call this codependency. I took him as a hostage to run my life. He got goofier than a snake about that time, and I knew I had to get away. He was so goofy, and I couldn't get away. I went and talked to a bunch of people, and they said, "Yes, you need to get away from him." I had to even get away from the groups where he had them. I had to change my sponsor and change my groups. I was terrified. My greatest hostage was my wife. I'd call her at 10 in the morning. I'd say, "Casey, I love you." She'd say, "I love you too." I'd call her at 3 in the afternoon. I'd say, "Casey, I love you." And she'd say, "I love you." Then I'd call her at 10 in the morning. I'd say, "Casey," and she wouldn't be home. And I'd call her at 3 and I'd say, "Casey, I love you. Where in the hell were you this morning?" I took her on my hip when we came into AA. And everywhere I went, Casey went. We prayed together. I took her hand. "Let's go to a meeting. It's time for supper. Let's have sex." Everything was on Burns' schedule. Boom, boom, boom. She came up to me 8 years in the program, and she changed from Al-Anon to AA at 6 years. And she came up to me. She'd had 2 years in AA, and I'd had eight. And she said, "Burns, I've never loved you more. I want to go back to school. I want to go into therapy, and I want to go to my own AA meetings." And I said, "Fine, Casey. What I thought was in you, bitch, I'll never trust you again." That's when I started this other journey I was telling you. I went to my sponsor, my new sponsor, Jack S. I think Jack's going to be in Little Rock next week. I said, "Jack, I'm going to get me another woman." He said, "That's fine. You can get another woman. If you don't change your attitude, you'll run her off too." I thought, my God, I don't know what he means. When the student's ready, the teacher will arrive. That's always been true for me in this program. Alcoholics Anonymous, a little pigeon of mine with 7 months of sobriety walked up and gave me 8 tapes and said, "Would you listen to these tapes and see if they're any good?" They were Joe and Charlie's tapes of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. As I listened to those tapes, God showed me the program I didn't have. I had 12 copies made and 12 of us sat down 7 years ago and began a big book study. It's changed over the years. New people have come in. People have died, slips, divorces. But that group studying those tapes and the big book have gone on for almost 7 years. What I found in that whole process was why I'm even on the face of this earth, to be of maximum service to God and to you. That's it. To be a maximum, to fit myself through my preparation to be a maximum service to God and to you. Why am I here? I'm here because I was asked to come. And I got a lot to share. Someone says, "Well, this looks like codependency." No, it's spirituality. Well, you can't give away what you haven't got, but by God, you got enough to take a... If you've had 24 hours of sobriety, you can take your car and take another drunk to a meeting. You may not be able to spell 12, but you can take him to a meeting. And if you want to get the maximum, work this process. So what about unacceptable behavior? And the greatest promise in this whole program for me is the promise we never read. It's the promise right before the promises. I alluded to it earlier. If we're sensible, tactful, considerate, and humble as God's people, we stand on our feet. We don't crawl before anybody. But I don't have to smack. I don't have to hit. I can merely say, "I have to go. If you want what I have, I'll give you everything I got. If you don't, then I'll take you to somebody who can give you more. If you don't want anything that we got here, please come back. Please come back."
and using this within my family, which is exactly where it all started, I began to support Casey. She graduated last year number one in her class. And I became a part of the solution rather than the problem. And all she wanted for her graduation was a red truck. And we got her a red truck, and her license plate says, "My truck." And she's a doll baby in it. We're in therapy right now, and I don't know if our marriage will survive. I really do not, for reasons that are not appropriate here. But I'll tell you what, this thing we're working through, we're doing with dignity. We're doing with spirituality. I do not know where God will take it. We have not drifted apart. We've just followed different paths, all with the same spiritual foundation. I truly believe our marriage will survive. I'm absolutely convinced that it will do what God wants it to do, and I know that we're working holding hands. And I know I love her. I'm an asset to my community. I'm an asset to AA. I'm an asset to my profession. And I'm an asset to me, thanks to the program by Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll tell you a couple of stories and I'll quit. You've been very patient. First has to do with my daughter. 16 years ago, she sat straddled at my chest. I was passed out drunk. She was on amphetamine, Darvon, Valium, and alcohol. She tried to shoot me with a shotgun, and the reason she didn't shoot me is she couldn't load the shotgun. It was an automatic gun. 4 years ago, my daughter came into Alcoholics Anonymous. She's been in AA 11 years. 3 years after she came into AA, she got married. And guess who she asked to give her away? Daddy. Last June the 22nd was Father's Day and my birthday. Casey and I had been to a conference. We came in, drove up the front driveway, and there were balloons on the mailbox, balloons above the garage, and balloons above the front door. And when I turned around, I said to the world's greatest dad on Father's Day, and happy birthday. This is the hope of Alcoholics Anonymous. This may not have happened in your life yet. Hope will be delivered in whatever package God chooses to send. Second thing is my son. He's 27. He's 26. He's been in AA 8 years. He went back and lived with his mother after he lived with us from age 11 to age 14. His alcoholism flourished. It flourished. He sold all of her silver and stole her car. She put him in jail, which is where she should have put him. He came back to me and it said, "All been worked out." Now, please understand what I'm saying. For a year, I'd been preparing myself and Casey with me to be spiritually ready to give this answer. Preparation. This was not precipitous. Burns came back and he said, "Daddy, Mama kicked me out of the house. I want to live with you." And I said, "Burns, you need to go off to treatment. I'll pay for it." And he said, "Treatment for what?" And I said, "Your alcoholism." He said, "I'm not an alcoholic." And I said, "If you're going to live with me, that's my call. If you want to live on the streets, that's your call." He said, "Then I'll live on the streets, you son of a bitch." I said, "I love you." And he walked out of the door, and I dropped on my knees and just sobbed, said, "God, please make sure I'm ready to answer your call." I knew where that boy was every day and every night for 4 months, and I knew God would let me know what to do. At the end of 4 months, he came back and said, "Daddy, please send me to treatment." Sent him to treatment. He came back home. About a year later, he was in a meeting with a bunch of us, and a woman said, "My son went off to treatment with two other boys. They caught them smoking dope. I know my son's smoking dope. What can I do to help him?" We all talked. Finally, my boy raised his hand and said, "I don't know what you can do to help him. I'll tell you what turned my life around." He said, "I saw my sister be a lovely, lovely person, and she got into drugs and alcohol, and she became somebody that I loved, but I wasn't proud of." So then she came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and she became a lady again. I said, "But what turned my life around was when I was out there on those streets, I remembered that my daddy used to come home drunk and he'd slap my mother and he'd come up and whip me and Libby. Then he left home and he didn't slap mother anymore, but he'd tell us he was coming to get us and said he wouldn't even show up." I said, "Then he went into Alcoholics Anonymous and he came home and told Mama he was sorry and paid her money that he owed her. And he quit lying to me and Sissy when he told us he'd be there, he'd show up." Said, "When I was out there on those streets, I realized I wanted to grow up to be just like my daddy." Burns went into Central Academy of Commercial Art and became a commercial artist. 6 months ago, he started a little business of his own. Didn't know anything about starting a business. Knows a lot about commercial art. Called me and asked me if I would share with him about starting my business. And so we went out to breakfast and we were talking. We got through and we walked out and I hugged him. I said, "I sure love you." And he said, "I love you too, Daddy." So I started across the walk. He said, "Hey, Dad." And I said, "What?" And he said, "Don't drink. Go to meetings and read the big book." Final story is my daddy. My mama died in 1978 of metastatic breast cancer. I'd been sober 8 months, and Casey and I went down and sat and talked with Mama almost every weekend. We made our amends, or I made mine to her. We had no problem. I loved her so deeply, and she loved me. I miss this little woman every day. God, what a wonderful lady. My daddy married another woman about 2 years later, and a lovely, lovely lady that was one of God's greatest gifts.
All my life, my daddy's always been there for me, but he never would say anything. He'd come. I broke my leg playing football, and he's the first one there to put me on a stretcher. I broke it playing basketball, first one to put me on a stretcher. I broke it playing baseball. I had bad legs. He came and picked me up, and he put me on a stretcher, but he never would say anything. He'd just always be there. He married this lady, and that was delightful, and I'd go down and we'd visit. Daddy never said much. About 4 years ago, Daddy started to lose his mind. It looked like Alzheimer's. It really wasn't. It was arteriosclerotic cerebral vascular disease, hardening of the blood vessels. It looks like Alzheimer's. About 2 years ago, he didn't even know who I was. He thought I was one of his brothers. He thought my brother was one of his brothers. He didn't even remember my mother. They put him in a nursing home. And I would drive down every other weekend, and on the way down, I'd say, God, please take away my pain. Please stop my pain, God. Please. Never worked. I felt like I was being gutted because he didn't even know who I was. Finally, this one Sunday, I drove into the parking lot, and I sat there, and I said, God, let me be for my daddy today what you want me to be. Let me be for my daddy today what you want me to be. I walked in, and I didn't call him daddy anymore because that confused him. He was sitting in the wheelchair. He's too weak to get out. And I said, Hal, can I help you? And he said, yeah, Buster. That's my uncle, he thought I was. He said, would you shave me? And I said, yeah, and I shaved daddy. I said, would you like to go in and have some lunch? And he said, yeah, I believe I would. So I rolled him in the wheelchair and got his food because he's too weak to feed himself. And I sat there and fed him. About that time, Peggy came in, and she and I sat opposite each other talking, and Daddy was sitting in a wheelchair. This scene had been reenacted hundreds of times. Mom and I talking, Daddy just sitting there watching. Mom and I talking, Daddy watching. I turned around, he was looking at me, and I said, would you like to go out on the sun porch? And he said, I believe I would, Buster. Rolled him out on the sun porch, and Peggy and I went out, and we're sitting there talking, and Daddy's sitting there watching. Finally, he just raised up in his wheelchair and looked me right square in the eye, and he said, son, today you're just like the little boy your mama and I raised. I love you very much. Thank you for coming to see me. Ten seconds later, he didn't know who I was. We buried him September the 6th, and he never knew who I was again. The miracle is not that my daddy recognized me. The miracle is that I said, dear God, let me be for my daddy what you want me to be. I thank you, Alcoholics Anonymous, because that's the journey. Alcoholics Anonymous is a language of the heart. We feel without touching, we hear without talking, we love by instinct. For the next few seconds, I'd like for you to either take the hand of the person next to you, close your eyes, bow your head, do whatever you want to do. But I'd like for you to feel with me this language of the heart. Close every talk the same way. When I couldn't literally walk, talk, and chew gum, I used to listen to tapes. And Father Martin had a tape, The 12 Steps of AA, and he closed it in a way which says it all. You people are in my thoughts frequently. You will be in my heart, and you will be in my prayers always. I love you from the bottom of my heart. I thank you for asking me to talk. Thank you for listening to me. Most of all, I thank you and all the rooms around this country that brought me the message that gave me and mine our lives. For those people that I'm seeing again, it's good to see you. For those people that I've met new, it's good to meet you and welcome into my life. For those people I may not meet, we will meet as we trudge this road of happy destiny. Until that time, Godspeed and good night.